Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California on KLRB. It's tape number 459, September 21st, 1980. We're having a little difficulty in the recording studio of getting these tapes synchronized with the machines turning them on in the other room while I'm on the air, so forgive the double introduction in case the tape cassette has it this time. This is the fourth anniversary of the murder of Orlando Letelier, the ex-envoy from Chile to the United States, and Ronnie Moffat. They were murdered in a car on Embassy Row. There is a good book out on murder on Embassy Row telling about this assassination inside the United States. I thought about them. I was looking up some articles about Frank Turple and an agent of the CIA named Mr. Wilson who was involved with that murder plan on Embassy Row. There's a good book out about the murder on Embassy Row. The two of the men that were charged with that murder have been released, and there's a suggestion of a new trial. For the time being, they have been taken out of jail. It seemed that the informants in the case, two of them were cellmates, so on a technicality, two people that killed Letelier and Moffat are now out, and they're asking for, as I say, for a new trial. There's so many events in American history, such as Kent State, the Letelier murder, and the John Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King's murder, Malcolm X. I added up into the hundreds, and it's good sometimes to remember those sad events. They're very much a part of our American system. Last week, I told you that I would discuss why I wasn't at Amnesty International. I've been working for the census since last April, and I didn't want to announce it on the air until I turned in my PIN. Our work actually terminated this Friday afternoon. If I were to say that I was working for the federal government in the census capacity, a lot of people may say she's too political or radical. We didn't discuss politics as an enumerator working in the office. That wasn't a thing we were supposed to do, but it was very valuable for me to work in that capacity these past months and to understand how the census works and the way it's compiled. The best way to understand something is to be a part of it, and I certainly was a part of it for many months. Some of the experiences were wonderful. I didn't run into any bureaucracy or any difficulty with personnel. I was told I would probably find a lot of people uptight. The people were just marvelous, and the work was interesting, and I was able to go all through the Carmel Valley and part of Salinas and down to Big Sur and meet all kinds of people and see all kinds of circumstances on the Monterey Peninsula that gave me a broader understanding of where I live. I do believe after completing this amount of time from April to September working with the census that if people were told about the Census Bureau and the way it works, that they would demand that every single form be destroyed tomorrow. The forms now are packed in the packing house and they'll be shipped out tomorrow to California. And then they go, some go to Indiana and some go to New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm very apprehensive about the Indiana collection because of Senator Lugar, the Tom Charles Houston plan, the COINTELPRO program that was set up by Richard Nixon, the Defense Department, the National Security Agency, and the FBI and CIA. The headquarters for that was in Indiana, and Bloomington, Indiana was the think tank for domestic counterintelligence for Operation Chaos that formed the SLA with Emily William Harris and Gary and Angela Atwood that came out to California to infiltrate the Indian movement and the Black Panthers and the United Prisoner Workers and the gay activists, the lesbians, the gays, all of the political activists, the Peace and Freedom Party, the Venceremos, Ramos, every political group was infiltrated and broken up, and the SLA was an excuse by the CIA to break into these groups and break them up. Just one brief explanation about the way the census works. We took an oath when we began the work, but I don't have to reveal names or people what happened, but the principle should be known to everybody. I think they have a right to know how it works. Taking in this geographical area, the one that I worked in, the state is broken into a group of numbers. I don't know how many, but our district office was a certain number, 3220, and that took from Santa Cruz down to San Luis Obispo and the area, this area of California. And then That is broken into about 1,100 different sections, and then each section or book of those 1,100, the enumerators go out to the homes or places where people can't be located. About 70% send in their forms, and then it's the job of the enumerator to find the other 30% or the vacant homes. And each person has a name and a number and a block number, and he's identified on the map instantly. So that from this time on, within 5 minutes, I think anybody in the United States who has filled in a form or has a post office box or a social security number probably could be identified very quickly. The disturbing thing was that if you take a residence, for example, say my home, May Brussels, and you put in a computer in alphabetical order into Carmel, California, like the telephone directory, and you look up a street via Crotola, and you have a map, the fourth house on the map on the right house side of the street is me. And every person's home is a number on a map, and every person has a number. And the maps accompany the books to their destination, and they're done over very accurately so that we're all pinpoint on a map. If you have 11 whites and one black and then 11 whites, the one black person is singled in that neighborhood, and neighborhoods are marked. And I have an article that was in the Washington Post last week that the Army is going to use the census forms for recruiting certain areas and the kind of people that would be desirable. I saw how quickly it worked to locate a particular person in a barracks where the number was off by one number, and within less than 4 minutes, you could correct the error. So there's a lot of people in Carmel Valley that are proud of their privacy. They live on certain streets where there's no name in the mailbox and no number on the mailbox, and they have a P.O. box in Carmel or Carmel Valley, and they think that they have a lot of privacy, and you go to their home, and they pride themselves in that. But the map has a serial number for that house, and the name at the end of the census period matches that house, so that no matter how much privacy they think they have from that moment on, they are a name, and it matches the dot, and other agencies do work with the census, and so when the books are completed and wrapped up, they're identified exactly on the map where they live. The most frightening thing of all, I thought, was some of the foster homes, the care centers for older people. Some you can go in or out, and they don't mind you coming to the door. Some you can't get past the door. They look like homes that are run by churches, and it reminds me of Jonestown. And one of them has a chain fence, and I'll do more work on that later. I don't want to talk too much about the Census Bureau. One interesting thing, I thought it was interesting, but it could be equally frightening, was numbering the members of the Indian tribes. There's a list of about 1,300 tribes, and they are not identified by name. They're after the name is put down by particular members of the Indian tribes. They're transcribed into codes for computers. They can be used for good to study these tribes and to study anthropology and American citizens, or they could be used for evil. I understand that 1/3 of the American Indians are now sterilized, and I always see the danger in these things more than the good. I suppose I shouldn't. But after Nazi Germany, you can't be too careful. And I feel that people were guaranteed privacy. I never did say that when I went around as a enumerator. I never said, if you tell me the information, I guarantee it won't be revealed for 75 years. I wouldn't say that because I don't know who receives it. Humans take the information and they pass it on to other humans, and not everybody is very nice. So I never forced anybody and never coaxed them to fill out a form. And one of the interesting things was doing the research and knowing how bad things are in this country, finding the 30% that resisted mailing in the forms. I was wondering the temper of the times. And most people are very complacent, and they're easygoing, and they're not nervous or angry, and they're not paranoid, and they're willing to give information, and they give more than you want or need, and they're generous and let you in the home. And I think out of 12 books, which I had with hundreds and hundreds of names, I got 4 refusals, and when I went back, the other 2 were perfectly willing to fill in whatever information there was, and they seemed agreeable and, as I say, complacent, and I expected more anger or hostility, but I didn't get it, and maybe that's good, and maybe it's bad. Maybe people are accepting things more than they should and should be aroused, but that wasn't my role. My role was to locate the home and how many people live there, and that's what I did. And then I found some very interesting things that maybe from time to time I'll refer to, but not this evening. I did mention last week the problem of the narcotic war between the two candidates, the control of the opium traffic between the Carter people, the Reagan people, and that running for president of the United States simply means covering your turf geographically that's sliced up between the major candidates and who's going to get a piece of the action. And I gave some very modest figures of the cost of crime. One of the subscribers to these radio tapes sent me a copy of Forbes. I don't know if you can get the magazine stands or not, or by subscription. If you can, get it or go to the library, September 29th, 1980. And on the cover, there is an article. It says, "Organized crime, unregulated, untaxed, and unstoppable." Now, many of you maybe hopefully think that I'm going to talk about the presidential debates tonight between John Anderson and Ronald Reagan. I think the debates are a terrible bore. The questions border on a possibility of getting some answers. The answers are vague. They don't deal, when they talk about inflation, with the organized crime inflating property or the increased cost of the payoffs and the arson. And the mob rule that has taken over in the major cities and in the small towns, too, where the mob has come in. Forbes has a breakdown of organized crime and describes it as a perfectly non-taxable, non-stoppable industry of $150 billion a year, chemicals being $149 billion, and then the auto industry down to $125 billion. And I see organized crime as the biggest threat to our freedom in this country and to our economic security. A lot of this untaxable money that they get, this $150 billion, is put into real estate, into hotels, into recreation, to campgrounds, to trucking for produce and food coming in, and into arson, burning down, and stealing cars, and loan sharking. This industry that is non-taxable, and the money is put over into foreign banks and then brought back and laundered and put into investments in our own hometowns, is running the people out of town who saved money, worked all their life, invested in their piece of property, and now the taxes are up on the property, they're taxed out, can't afford it, and income people of organized crime will put down $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, $500,000 on a piece of property that maybe in somebody's old age or in their expectations would be $60,000, $70,000. The young people can't afford homes, and this huge hunk of money is unlimited for people in the organized crime businesses. They refer to garbage collection, jukeboxes, and marijuana, and narcotics, and so forth. There was a convention or a group that had a report last week in Philadelphia on organized crime. They said 60 million tons of narcotics were brought into the United States in 1980, 10 million the year before, 60 million last year, and in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They put out a report that I want to send for the Crime Commission, called it A Decade of Organized Crime, just on the Pennsylvania Mafia groups and 14 other groups in New York and New Jersey, and it lists the crime families. But all these statistics still don't go into what happens to the rural areas, the small towns, the private businesses, that the mom and pop stores that are being squeezed out, the payoffs under the table, the cost of delivering the produce, the cost of manufacturing things that you wear and need. The crime figures have never been brought up to any of the candidates and never will, and yet they affect our lives, and the answers that they give to inflation and to savings and so forth are so general, they can use the same time-worn phrases over and over again for every election, but they don't address themselves to the basic needs of people, which are being affected by this $120 billion industry that is totally non-taxable and has to come some way back into our lives to affect our lives. Now, Forbes, in their article, goes into the payoffs of politicians, legislatures, courtrooms, government bureaucrats, the press, the universities, the churches, legitimate businesses. If they pay off all of these groups in order to conceal their operations, and murder for hire, which is a very profitable business, the blackmail and the murdering, the crime lords are becoming the number one problem, I believe, in this country. And as the cover of Forbes says, unregulated, untaxed, and unstoppable, all because they began by paying off these politicians very, very long time ago. Tom Dewey and Earl Warren were part of that, Richard Nixon and his gang, and of course, Joe Kennedy wasn't beyond the organized crime league. He worked with them with his liquor industry and so forth. He was part of that, and Aristotle Onassis, the top people that rub with our politicians and affect the presidents, and Paul Laxalt from Las Vegas, Nevada, running the Reagan campaign, and Reagan's buddies in California, all interwoven with organized crime and assassination hit teams. The politicians are so much a part of the organized crime syndrome that they can't speak up or they'll be blackmailed and smeared, so they avoid this big problem. And that's one reason I think that these debates are such a bore, because they don't get down to the things that really affect our lives and they're going to affect us in the future. It's going to get worse. It isn't going to get better. I got a letter from one of my tape subscribers, listeners, asking me to clarify the remark that I made about the Vietnam War and how the Flower Children dropped away after the war, that it wasn't really a movement. They just didn't want to go to war, and they felt sorry for the Vietnamese. But as soon as the war was over, they went into this so-called Me Too or selfish attitude and didn't continue the fight, even though the repressions got worse after the Vietnam War. Starvation around the world and the COINTELPRO program at home, the Operation Chaos, the assassinations increasing in number and so forth. I was referring specifically to what was the hippie movement, which had no substance and no real leaders, people like Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman and so forth, who were really clowns with no ideological basis, people that were sincere in what they did, like Richard Harris, who went to jail for several years and came out and is working against nuclear waste and against nuclear power. Now, he's very low-key and doesn't get the attention of the media that these other clowns did, who are now working on Wall Street and making a lot of money but ignoring the problems at home and overseas. What I meant, and I clarify that, is that the so-called Flower Power Group were self-centered and found a joy in leaving home and the establishment, but didn't take the time to study history or the substance of history to know how real the problems were or how to face them when they were adults. Speaking of facing them, there's an article in the Monterey Herald this morning from the Los Angeles Times. Ex-Nazi Army officer was elected this last week president of the UN Assembly. Baron Rüdiger von Wechmar of West Germany, who fought in Rommel's Africa Corps, was captured by the Allied troops, was proud to be a Nazi, has never apologized for it. He's 57 years old. He is now head of the United Nations. The article goes on to explain that he divided his time after World War II between diplomacy and journalism, and first was a prisoner of war in Virginia and Maryland. That's an interesting thing, because many so-called war criminals lived at the farm that later became the compound and training place for terrorism and CIA assassination teams. They were brought from Germany to the United States, to Virginia and Maryland, and the Germans were then training the Americans in counterintelligence and assassination teams. This von Wechmar came to the United States, to Virginia and Maryland, then went back to Germany and worked for the press agency and worked for the United Press. From 1947, the year the CIA was formed, he was the bureau chief for the news agency in Bonn. He took that over from 1954 to 1958. You can see why people like Gerald Ford, who was on the Warren Commission, Gerald Ford, in the minutes of the meeting of the Warren Commission, one of the first meetings, they asked, how will we handle the press? And Gerald Ford said, I can handle the AP and the UPI, the Associated Press and the United Press International. When the Warren Commission wanted a historian to write the account of how the President of the United States was murdered in Dallas, they called Otto Winokur, a German, the chief historian of the Pentagon, described in the book Who's Who in the CIA, and Earl Warren and Mr. Rankin, the chief counsel of the Warren Commission, brought in Otto Winokur. So here's a man representing the United Press International in Germany. He came over to the United Nations and, as I say, has never apologized for being a Nazi. Kurt Waldheim, the former Secretary General, claimed that he was forced to become a Nazi when Austria was annexed
and he had to serve on the Eastern Front. He said he was pressed in army service. But now, for the second time, we have a Nazi, but this one never apologized and was employed by the news media in Germany for the United Press. Also, in the Monterey Herald today was a long article on Eisenhower, A New Perspective. There have been many articles on that, and there's a photograph of Eisenhower in 1957 with Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, another German German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer, and Bonn Foreign Minister Heinrich von Brentano. Eisenhower had access to world leaders, this article says, as a result of his military commanding as an officer, and he could meet with these important people. And you see John Foster Dulles, whose brother Alan Dulles had formed the CIA from the OSS, and the year of this photograph is 1957. The article goes on to say, in essence, that Alan Dulles was in touch, daily contact with Eisenhower in the State Department. Of course, he worked closely with his brother. And it tells about some of the errors, their bungling, that Eisenhower made in the creative use of the CIA in their covert activities, such as overthrowing Guatemala and Iran, and their interference in Cuba and in the Congo and Indonesia, and breaking the Geneva Accords in Vietnam. And the article says that Eisenhower wasn't that mellow, sweet, aging hero. The historic version is that he, butter wouldn't melt in his mouth. He was just sitting back, low-key, after the war. And now they look back with his documents and records and find that he had a very strong position with German officials, with the Dulles brothers, that counterintelligence was rampant. He was overthrowing countries with the counterintelligence of the CIA. He was in daily touch with the hawks in Congress, and that Eisenhower very much shaped the foreign policy of the United States after the war to assist the Germans to rearm the third time, this time against the Soviet Union. If you keep in mind the historical record of how the Versailles Treaty was betrayed, and Germany started rearming immediately after World War I, and when that war was over, World War II began, and they were rearming it. By 1943, the Americans and Germans were making deals to get ready to rearm, and they stalled that war so that they could get the money out of Germany and the treasures and the documents to get ready for World War III. If you keep that script in mind and repeat it very often, then you can understand the framework of the news as it's going on today. The picture of Eisenhower with these German officials and Dulles is interesting because, as I say, under the caption it says, in 1957, he was having that conference. There was an article in the Los Angeles Times this week I've been keeping up on a man from the Beverly Hills Police Department named Captain Jack Eggers. And we transfer from Eisenhower in 1957 with the German officials to Beverly Hills, California in 1957. That was the year that Howard Hughes was taken to the Beverly Hills Hotel from 1957 to 1966, literally kidnapped by organized crime and the CIA, kept in a bungalow. Jack Eggers was supplying the narcotics and the drugs for Howard Hughes. He was the middleman to keep Hughes under lock and key while the Hughes organization and the aerospace organization was building up, again, the spy system, the U-2 planes, the satellites, the communications that are being built now for World War III. And under the Hughes organization, as I studied Hughes, every book that's been written on Howard Hughes and the Hughes Medical Institute and the person, Howard Hughes, I realized that it was an umbrella for the Nazification of America. Now, Jack Eggers was removed from the Beverly Hills Police Department at the time of a murder of Bobby Hall. It had to do with a complicated narcotics, the supplying of narcotics for Hughes, the narcotics for the politicians in Los Angeles, California. And Hall was collecting tape cassettes of important politicians when he was gunned down and killed. And a man who killed Bobby Hall had called Jack Eggers, the Beverly Hills police chief, who was the control man for the body of Howard Hughes, and said, "I'm going to kill Bobby." And then they called back later and said he was dead. Eggers had to resign. And then following that, a assassin from Argentina, a man who lived in Culver City but had fled to Argentina, came back and is being held for the attempted murder of Jack Eggers. Eggers caught on There were two people that were supposed to kill Eggers. Eggers' life is probably, I wouldn't say his life expectancy is too long. Knowing what he knows, one of the men who tried to kill him got off, and the other one was charged with killing a man, a Mr. Kent Chong Wong. It's a drug deal. I don't know whether these were the drugs that went to the Hollywood scene and the Hollywood politicians, or the drugs that went to Howard Hughes, but another drug-related slaying occurred that had to do with Jack Eggers and the attempt to kill Eggers, and the men are being charged with murdering one man and attempt to murder Jack Eggers. But that name is one to remember because of the importance of his being the middleman or the control man of the organization, the Summa Corporation head, Hughes, who was just a figurehead who really didn't exist and wasn't seen except by the entourage around him, referred to as the Mormon Mafia, that took over his body and his messages until he was taken to a Boston hospital in 1966. There's a new book out on Lyndon Johnson by Merle Miller, an oral biography called Lyndon, and there's excerpts of that running in the San Jose Mercury. I haven't gotten the book yet, but the history of our times, the character of Lyndon Johnson, the Texas politics, the crime figures, the organized crime figures, his connections to Vesco, Robert Vesco, and Richard Nixon are so interwoven. LBJ was the head of NASA that brought over Wernher von Braun and the top Nazis for the aerospace industry, that worked at Bell Helicopter and Hughes Aerospace. And just, there was one sentence in this book on the Kennedy assassination excerpted that just about summarizes what the researchers have to contend with. As every new history comes out, it gets more watered down. This book refers to the special commission that was appointed by Lyndon Johnson to investigate the killing of President John Kennedy. The official report, according to Merle Miller, was that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, unaided, and slightly crazed. He killed John Kennedy. There were some who refused to believe the report's full story. Lyndon Johnson was among them, believing at first it was the Vietnamese who were involved and later the Cubans who were involved. So you see, Lyndon Johnson now has the Vietnamese as a potential to the killing of John Kennedy, which is really stretching it. Maybe the Cubans, maybe the anti-Castro Cubans, but this is the first time Vietnamese were brought into Dealey Plaza or to Bethesda Hospital to do the autopsy, or with Marina Oswald. I hadn't heard about the Vietnamese, but every 10 or 15 years, new versions come out so that people picking up this book who haven't studied the history of the Warren Commission hearings may believe that the Vietnamese really killed John Kennedy. This evening on the debates, Bill Moyer was the moderator. Bill Moyer looks so mild. He represents public broadcasting. He's on public broadcasting all the time, Channel 9 out here. People may not realize or don't know the book that came out a long time ago, Who's Who in the CIA, this Bill Moyer, and Bill Moyer was Lyndon Johnson's closest buddy. He was his press secretary through the whole cover-up of the Kennedy assassination and through those years in the White House of the Vietnam War. That was Bill Moyer's role. And then after that era is over of the Vietnam War, Bill Moyer comes on public radio as a so-called liberal or left, taking on the aura, say, of Ramsey Clark and Mark Lane and some of these so-called leftist concerned people. He comes on very mild. Bill Moyer is the moderator for this program, and I think the people that were involved in the cover-up of the Kennedy murder and the Vietnam War and the lies about the Holocaust in Vietnam of Cambodia and Laos and all Southeast Asia with its massive narcotic traffic and bringing in of drugs, Air America and the CIA should not be allowed to have access to public broadcasting, much less be projected as great moderators for the youthful generation to look up to, like Dan Rather on television, or Cronkite. Rather was in Dallas at Dealey Plaza when Kennedy was killed. He described the head as going forward when the head went backwards of John Kennedy. He's always covered up and never acknowledged that there was a conspiracy there, and he's worked his way up to be one of the top broadcasters in the country. There are people over in Afghanistan that want to charge him with having several people murdered so that they could make a television documentary over there. But we wouldn't send heroes like Dan Rather to be tried for murder in order to make a movie have a murder take place. That will never happen. Speaking of murders, this last week the judge stopped the plans to open the grave of Lee Harvey Oswald. I've done many broadcasts on the Oswald doubles. Personally and for selfish reasons, I was very pleased that the judge said that because I spent 17 years researching Lee Harvey Oswald and the doubles, and I'm writing a book, all the research is done, and now that the census work is over, I will be spending most of my mornings and afternoons and evenings just working on that book. If the grave were opened and there was no body there, there would be an instant bantam book by somebody like William Stevenson, who did a book on Entebbe. We'd have instant books out that did not have the historical documents to designate the difference between the many Lee Harvey Oswalds that were floating around from 1959 to 1963. So I'm very pleased for selfish reasons that the grave is not going to be opened, and then maybe when I finish my book, there'll be more compelling reasons to bring up the case again. An interesting point, I read in one of my newspaper articles that the judge offered to make a settlement with Michael Eddowes in exchange for not opening the grave. Now, I didn't realize...
Wash your dishes by hand. Don't let the...